Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is John Glinsky. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I represent the appellants Karen Daly and Daniel Campbell. Our argument is relatively simple and straightforward, and it's actually, in a sense, summarized on page 19 of Armstrong's brief. In the middle of that page, it states, under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, criminal prosecutions must comport with prevailing notions of fundamental fairness. This standard requires that criminal defendants be afforded a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense. To safeguard that right, the court has developed what might loosely be called an area of constitutionally guaranteed access to evidence. And they go on to say, Brady and Youngblood Dash Trombetta are two of the constitutional privileges that help define this right, ensuring that exculpatory evidence is delivered into the hands of the accused, thereby protecting the innocent from erroneous conviction and ensuring the integrity of the criminal justice system. Our position is that although Brady, Youngblood, and Trombetta deal with different situations regarding the evidence, the purpose is still the same. The purpose is to ensure a fair trial.
What happens if a police officer simply makes up a false arrest report, testifies falsely at a probable cause hearing, person is detained for, let's say, a year leading to trial before being acquitted? Is that actionable?
Well, I think if you can show that the probable cause hearing was erroneous, I think that's a situation that was addressed in some cases, but there you have a fundamental flaw right from the beginning. But if you have an honest probable cause hearing,
but the fact that you have a later trial doesn't excuse the police officer's framing that causes a deprivation of liberty for a long time, right?
True, but in the case where I'm representing my clients, we're talking about after he had served 29 years and was then awaiting a retrial.
After he served 26 years,
right.
And he had three more to go because the decision was made to pursue trial again,
right. But he was
without
not
the exculpatory evidence from the bathrobe belt, right?
Right. But he's not attacking the original probable cause hearing.
Not with you. No, I'm asking, though, about your argument. Yeah. You're arguing that in essence, because there was never a trial, there was no actionable constitutional violation on the part of your clients, correct?
Correct.
So, in the instance of the police officer, similarly, there could be no trial. There would still be an actionable violation where it led to deprivation of liberty for a substantial period of time, correct?
Well, that could be, but I don't think that's the same situation, Your Honor. We're talking about a situation more similar to Brady where evidence has been suppressed and it has to be provided to the defendant in time to make use of it at trial. Youngblood and Trombetta are not that dissimilar, except the evidence is no longer available. But just like in Brady, the court has to make the determination whether there's probable reason to believe that it would have affected the outcome. I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
I'm sorry. But bottom line, isn't it so that the additional 3 years in prison are completely, totally attributable to the actions in destroying the sample? I mean, isn't that the bottom line here?
Not necessarily. There's no, we don't know for sure whether that, just like any suppressed evidence.
This is on a motion, right?
Right.
So we've got to take the plaintiff's versions of
right.
the facts?
Correct.
So don't we have to assume what Judge Rovner is asking you to assume?
I mean, you were talking about the integrity of the system. And here you have an individual who's awaiting the dismissal. He's still incarcerated. He's incarcerated
Correct.
An additional 3 years. And what you're saying is that there was no procedural due process violation because the court dismissed the charges without a trial. It just doesn't hang together for me.
Well, to me, what you've got are three different situations. With Brady, you've got suppressed evidence. With Youngblood, you've got destroyed evidence that had potential value, but there was bad faith. Or in Trombetta, you have apparent exculpatory value, and then you have it can't, there's no alternate replacement for it, or any way they can get the evidence. But either way, you're talking about evidence that doesn't necessarily prove his innocence. It's evidence that the court has to determine, as it does in Brady, whether it's suppressed evidence or destroyed or lost evidence, has to determine whether there was a reasonable probability that had it, if it still existed, it would have affected the outcome of the proceeding. The proceeding they're talking about is the trial. Now, in this case, of course, the court determined before the trial he couldn't get a fair trial, so it was dismissed. But these are evidentiary rights, the purpose of which is to guarantee a fair trial. Well, if you can either get a fair trial, or if it's dismissed before the trial, you have the equivalent because you never even have a trial. The charges are dismissed.
So in essence, this is prison three more years.
3 years, no harm, no foul.
No harm.
Well, no. Okay, wait a minute though, because you've got, that's based on a probable cause hearing. But if you can show there isn't probable cause, he has an action for malicious prosecution or wrongful imprisonment. He's got a state remedy. And this is a random and unauthorized act, as it is alleged in the second amended complaint, because he's in violation of a specific court order.
Is that the only state law that he violated, that your clients violated?
That I'm aware of, Your Honor, right.
So without the court order, would there be a state law remedy?
Well, I'm using the state order to argue that this was a random and unauthorized act.
Well, yeah, Parrott really doesn't have anything to do with this, mm-hmm. I've got to tell you. That whole line of cases, and I think where you're headed with this is in essence trying to revisit the Supreme Court's decision in Monroe versus Pape, which held, more than 50 years ago, that the fact that the state official has violated state law doesn't mean you cannot pursue a claim under 1983. Parrott is a very narrow exception for that.
Right.
With respect to the state remedy, on this state damages cap of $250,000, is that per defendant, per occurrence, per lawsuit, or what?
Per defendant.
Per defendant. Okay. And what level of damages cap do you think is sufficient to serve the federal constitutional purposes, and how do we go about gauging that?
I really don't know the answer to that question. It does have to be adequate, but
would $50,000 be enough?
I don't know. In this case, it would have been at least 80-some thousand a year, because it'd be $250,000 over the 3 years.
Would $50,000 be enough?
I would say so. I know personally I have settled mentally many cases for less than that per year of wrongful incarceration.
You know what jury verdicts are like in that area?
All over the board, yes.
Some pretty high.
Some pretty
high. $1 million a year and up.
Some pretty high. But I have settled any number of cases for a lot less than that against attorneys who are very experienced and very successful in civil rights actions.
Under federal law or state law?
Federal law, 1983 actions.
Okay. Can the plaintiff pursue those claims now in state court?
No.
No.
Did not file a notice of claim.
Okay.
But of course, it's been held that what's important is whether there was an adequate remedy at the time that he could have availed himself of, and he could have. I'm already into my rebuttal time, so I will quit unless there are other questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glinsky. Ms. Horn?
Joel isn't the other defendant.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I didn't have my second card here. Do you have the list there?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Mr. Yanicek.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excuse me.
If the court please, good morning. I am Tim Yanicek. I represent defendant appellant John Norsetter. My representation of Mr. Norsetter arises out of a period of time in 1980 before the prosecution of Mr. Armstrong began, and when assistant district attorneys in Wisconsin, such as Mr. Norsetter, were employees of the county in which they served rather than the state, as they are now. We're asking the court to reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Norsetter's motion to dismiss on qualified immunity grounds.
I just want to ask you how you think we can tell at this early stage of the proceedings whether the conduct was actually random and unauthorized. I mean, isn't that an issue better left for summary judgment?
Your Honor, for this argument, the qualified immunity argument, we're not relying on a random and unauthorized act. We are relying strictly on the requirement in qualified immunity law that the law be clearly established at the time that the, in this case, Mr. Norstetter made his
decision. You mean just for Mr. Norstetter?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been alleged by Armstrong that Mr. Norstetter allowed or caused drugs and paraphernalia seized at the murder scene in this case to be lost or destroyed. And this drug evidence was not tested before it was lost or destroyed. Mr. Armstrong's theory of liability against Assistant District Attorney Norstetter is that the drug evidence, once tested, might have yielded evidence of the identity of a different perpetrator of the crimes. Qualified immunity, of course, is available to government officials such as Mr. Norstetter if his evidence-collecting actions did not violate clearly established law at that time in 1980. Your Honor, I assert that there was not in 1980, and there still is not now, clearly established law prohibiting law enforcement from failing to preserve materials which do not have exculpatory value that is apparent to them.
Now, Mr. Yanicek, I'm troubled by the loss of this evidence and the circumstances and what was known about it. You've argued in your brief that, in essence, this couldn't possibly have been relevant, right?
It was not recognized as being relevant at the time. Could not possibly have been recognized as being relevant.
Now, we know that Mr. Norstetter was, at least based on as the record comes to us, we have to assume that Mr. Norstetter had decided very early on that Mr. Armstrong was guilty of this awful crime. And I got to say, it's hard for me to believe that if the drug evidence had had Mr. Armstrong's fingerprints on it, that wouldn't have been a huge part of the trial, putting him at the scene, at the time, with the victim, doing something illegal and potentially impairing the victim, right?
If the evidence were found to have Armstrong's
and
DNA,
Mr. Norstetter
whatever,
yes. Didn't bother to check this?
He did not. Nobody did, Your Honor. The evidence was put in an evidence bag and sent to the police department where it was later lost.
Well, let's assume for a second that maybe it was exculpatory, just for purposes of argument. In 1980, Brady was well established, right?
Right.
And at that time, so Brady tells us that prosecutors and police investigators, and at that time Norstetter's acting as an investigator, they can't suppress exculpatory evidence, right?
That's right.
So wouldn't it reasonably follow that if you can't suppress it, you also cannot destroy it?
Your Honor, for the sake of argument, no, that would not necessarily follow. There are many
What rational basis could you say, well, I know I can't hide this exculpatory evidence, but it's okay for me to burn it or throw it away?
You know, the police officers were there to investigate a brutal rape and murder.
And this evidence of drug use on the scene at the time was irrelevant.
It was not exculpatory. That's the point.
Well, maybe not. Suppose it had been exculpatory. Would you agree with me then that Brady would, that in essence Brady's logic would clearly extend to destruction?
Intentional destruction, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, or bad faith destruction.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. The investigators, including Assistant District Attorney Norstetter at this point, though, did not recognize the apparent or obvious exculpatory nature of this crime. It has never been tested. Testing subsequently may have proven that it was inculpatory. going directly to your point, Your Honor, that wouldn't this be important for the prosecution to have too? But we do not know.
Well, we know Norsetter has testified that no evidence would have changed his mind, right?
His personal mind, right. But whether he would have continued to prosecute this person under those circumstances is a different question.
Sienicek, does the record reflect the date of the destruction?
Not specifically, Your Honor.
You mean there's been no discovery to produce any records of... It was destroyed, what, in the normal course? Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's alleged in the plaintiff's complaint that it was...
Right. So, and there's no indication of how much time post the initial investigation this was destroyed?
No, it is not in the record whether that was even before or after his criminal complaint, before his criminal trial.
So we don't know, once it was placed in the locker, which I assume was relatively contemporaneous with the collection, whether it was destroyed within a day or 2 years or any, we have no idea?
It's not in the record, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes. And whether this obligation of Mr. Norsetter, whatever it may have been, was clearly established in 1980, we think very clear answer to that question came in 1984 and in 1988 when Trombetta and Longblood were announced and handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. The law that the court itself recognized that it had not adequately, had not clearly established the law in that area, and it was going to try to proceed to do so in both Trombetta and Youngblood.
Could you address the significance of this court's decision in Heidelberg against Hammer, which was 2 years before the loss of these materials, and which dealt with which held that there was an actionable basis for destruction of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. Heidelberg, of course, as you know, dealt with destroyed and falsified lineup report and police tape losses. There was absolute liability.
There was immunity, absolute immunity.
Excuse me. There was absolute immunity for the prosecutors, but the police officers who had committed those acts did
so
not...
destruction of property, of evidence.
Deliberate destruction of property known to be exculpatory was found in Heidelberg to be improper. So, but even in that case, Your Honor, and Mr. Norsetter is not being accused of anything of that magnitude, at least in the complaint. He allowed this evidence to be destroyed, not knowing whether it was exculpatory or inculpatory.
Did he affirmatively approve of that, or was it just happened without his knowledge?
Your Honor, if you're specifically asking me to go outside the record, I can say that he...
Let's stick with the allegations.
Mm-hmm. All right. It's not stated. He allowed it to happen.
Okay.
He did not affirmatively take steps to preserve it, I think is a fair way to read
Would
the
you
plaintiff's
repeat
complaint.
That again?
Yeah, yes, sir.
Yeah. Could you raise your voice a little?
Well, I'm very sorry. I'll try to repeat what I just said. And, Your Honor, would you mind restating the question so I can have it firmly in mind when I say that?
What exactly is alleged with respect to Norsetter's role in the destruction of the drug evidence in 1980?
All right. As I recall the Second Amendment complaint of the plaintiff, it is that he allowed the evidence to be destroyed. He did not take affirmative steps to preserve it. It was destroyed in the normal course of police operations because it was not part of the crime they were investigating.
Yeah, but when you say he allowed it, does that? Well, I guess I'm not exactly clear on that. Is it when he allows it because once it goes into police custody, it's basically a decision of law enforcement, the police? Or when you say allows it, he did not object? I mean, what do you mean by allowed?
Yeah, I'm saying allowed because that's what the plaintiff alleged.
I understand that.
And that the fact of the matter is Norsetter had nothing to do with that evidence once it went into the police custody. It was the police who allowed it to be destroyed.
Thank you, Mr.
My red light. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Now, Ms. Horn.
Good morning. My name is Gail Horn, and I represent Ralph Armstrong. Ralph Armstrong spent nearly 3 decades in prison for a rape and a murder that he did not commit. He has raised 2 claims that are part of this appeal. The defendant, Norsetter, violated his due process rights in 1980 by destroying exculpatory crime scene evidence, and the defendants Daly and Campbell violated his due process rights by destroying a semen stain in 2006 that was obviously exculpatory. Now, the appeal by the defendants is an effort to close the federal courthouse doors for some of the most egregious due process violations. We agree with the defendants that Youngblood and Brady relate to the fundamental right to be able to access evidence and present a meaningful and complete defense, a defense that allowed, that would have allowed Mr. Armstrong to prove that he was innocent. Now, I can address each of their arguments in turn. With regard to the semen stain, the argument that the defendants are trying to make is that Brady and Youngblood are identical. And what we've said is sure, they're sisters, but they're not twins. And they both come out of this fundamental right that a criminal defendant has to present a meaningful defense. But the nature of the violations is slightly different. And that nature impacts whether or not a trial is necessary to remedy, civilly remedy, a constitutional violation.
I'm going to ask you to zero in, please, on your response regarding Norsetter.
Your Honor, our response with regard to Norsetter is, I can start with the qualified immunity inquiry that Mr. Yanicek talked about. As Your Honor recognized, by 1980, Brady was clearly established. It was clearly established to any state officer that they couldn't unlawfully suppress exculpatory evidence. I think Heidelberg also, as this court recognizes, indicated to an officer that they couldn't destroy evidence either.
There's police officers destroy.
But what Field says is that when you're conducting a qualified immunity inquiry, you look at the conduct of the state officer. You don't look at whether liability had subsequently been imposed. And I think if we look at, under that framework, both Heidelberg taken together with Brady make it obvious that defendant Norsetter would have been on notice that destroying exculpatory evidence from the crime scene was unlawful. A liability
inquiry. Destroying, right. But are you also saying that that established the duty to preserve potentially exculpatory evidence?
Your Honor, I think that they're one and the same. I do. And with regard to the allegations in plaintiff's complaint, it wasn't just that defendant Norsetter allowed this evidence to rot away. It was actually that Norsetter advised and directed the police on every aspect of their investigation, including evidence collection and evidence retention. And you'll have to remember that this complaint that we are operating on was a pro se complaint filed by Mr. Armstrong. And so I think that that allegation makes it clear that Norsetter wasn't sitting in an office saying, sure, whatever happens to the evidence, happens to the evidence. He was actually actively directing the criminal investigation. And so I think for that reason, whether or not you think evidence destruction or allowing preservation of evidence are different, in this context, it doesn't matter.
Well, Ms. Horn, could I ask you to reflect upon the Trombetta statement by the court that in 1984 we had never squarely addressed the government's duty to preserve evidence on behalf of criminal defendants?
I think that at most Trombetta is clarifying the preservation requirement. I think prior to Trombetta, the court had addressed withholding exculpatory evidence, destroying exculpatory evidence, and I think this circuit had also addressed those issues. And I think
Doesn't this turn, though, on what was known or suspected about the value of the evidence in question?
Yes, Your Honor. To the extent that the evidence would have to fall within Brady's framework or Heidelberg's announcement in order to...
Isn't the problem here that we simply don't know anything about the drug evidence in question?
Well, what we know about the drug evidence is that Mr. Armstrong had told the police right away, I mean, he knew the victim, that he had an alibi. The alibi was corroborated. He said, I did not do drugs with her on the night of the crime. And so we know that that evidence, and we know that Mr. Armstrong didn't commit this crime. The DNA evidence exculpated
When did he provide the alibi?
Immediately. He went to the police station immediately after the crime occurred because he was a friend of the victim. And so we know that that evidence, we certainly don't know whether or not we can test it. And that's due to the misconduct of the defendants, as plaintiff has alleged. But we know that had there been any fingerprints or any DNA or anything on the mirror, on the razor blade, on the straw, that that evidence would not have implicated Mr. Armstrong.
Okay. And what was, we know that now.
Correct.
Based on the DNA evidence later. But what was known at the time when this was, quote, allowed to be destroyed?
Well, Your Honor, if I may go into the allegations in the complaint, mm-hmm. this was, as you have recognized, Defendant Norsetter said, unless he saw Mr. Armstrong commit this, or unless he saw the crime being committed on videotape, and Mr. Armstrong was not on that videotape, he would never believe that Mr. Armstrong was innocent. So what we knew at the time of the probable cause charges, is that Mr. Armstrong had an alibi. That alibi was corroborated. We knew that Mr. Armstrong denied not only committing the crime, but using drugs with the victim on that night. We also knew that the police, with the aid of Defendant Norsetter, went to extraordinary lengths to get an eyewitness to finger Mr. Armstrong. And Mr. Armstrong talked about that in the complaint, and we've talked about that as well in our brief. They coerced this witness. They used a hypnosis on the witness, and during the hypnosis, they actually showed him a picture of Mr. Armstrong and his car. And they also created a lineup that, if it weren't for the fact that Mr. Armstrong went to prison based on this, it would be laughable. It was a bunch of police officers wearing wigs, and the witness said, I knew exactly who they wanted me to pick. He was the only guy not wearing a wig. So we knew at the time of probable cause, at the time that this evidence may have been destroyed, that Norsetter knew all of those facts, yet went ahead and destroyed this exculpatory evidence in an effort to frame Mr. Armstrong for a crime that he did not commit.
So but the theory that you're presenting to us then is that you're going to have to ultimately persuade a jury that Mr. Norsetter must have strongly believed that this would exculpate Armstrong, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Based on this other circumstantial evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Let me ask you about, if I recall correctly, we've been told that this missing drug evidence was not actually used at trial. That is, in his defense, he didn't point to the fact that this evidence had been lost to help defend himself. Now, doesn't that seem to indicate that maybe it just wasn't all that big a deal at the time?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, you can imagine the distinction between saying, well, they lost a bunch of drug evidence, and I'm sure that whoever committed it is the person who was doing the drugs. That sounds very self-serving when you're sitting in a criminal defendant's position, versus saying there was drug evidence and they were able to lift a fingerprint, and that fingerprint identified the real killer. I think those are two very different paradigms that we're working off of. And I think at bottom, a lot of the questions that this court is asking are really questions that would be better answered and better served in the discovery process. And I think that Judge Crabb, in issuing her order, recognized that. She said that to the extent, you know, we need to, the pleadings themselves are sufficient, as we are in a motion to dismiss stage, and to the extent that the defendant Norsetter may have a defense to this, that needs to await the discovery process.
So your suggestion is that it might have to be revisited, the question of qualified immunity, after discovery?
Well, my suggestion is that there is certainly the claim, it needs to be revisited potentially after discovery. But on the face of the complaint, it satisfies both the pleading requirements and the plausibility requirements that the Supreme Court has read into Rule 8. And therefore, the arguments about what he knew or the nuances of how the evidence might have played out at a criminal trial need to await the discovery process.
Ms. Warren, could I ask you about your claims against Daly and Campbell?
Yes,
and in particular, this issue about your malicious prosecution, federal malicious prosecution claim. My first question is whether we've got appellate jurisdiction to consider the malicious prosecution claim that the district judge had rejected.
I think that this court can affirm the district court's ruling on any grounds. I think, for example, Newsom is an example of that, where the litigant was pressing a malicious pressing a malicious prosecution claim, and this court said, actually, what you have is a due process claim in the original sense.
Well, that's okay. The problem I have is that we're here on an interlocutory appeal, only on the qualified immunity defenses. Mm-hmm. And the question is whether that lets us under what's usually treated as a very tight notion of pendant appellate jurisdiction would let us get into the merits of your malicious prosecution theories.
Your Honor, I do think that this court would have jurisdiction over that issue. It is, a pure question of law, and it rests on...
Well, that doesn't... The question is how closely it's related to the questions that are properly before us.
And I think it, as to that point, I think it is... It's very closely related because we're alleging the same acts constituted his malicious prosecution as constituted his Youngblood and Trombetta claims.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there are different elements to each, but certainly pled in the alternative, it's the same acts.
If we get to the merits... of that issue. Apparently the damages cap is five times what you told us in the brief, again, at least for Daly and Campbell. So why isn't that enough to make the state remedy viable?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the damages cap is $250,000.
Right.
And I would argue that being deprived of your liberty is one of the most egregious harms that an individual can face. And as you recognize during my counsel's argument, this court has affirmed and other courts have affirmed up to $1 million a year. So certainly $250,000 for 3 years of wrongful conviction, that's $50,000 a year.
What legal standard do we apply in figuring this one out?
In calculating this issue, you would apply the Parrott standard of whether it was a adequate and meaningful remedy. And we have cited cases in our brief that talk about that doesn't just mean closing the courthouse doors. That doesn't just mean the only time you can't have a meaningful or adequate remedy is when you have no remedy at all. It can also mean that there is a legally inadequate remedy. And I think that this court's opinion in Parrish addressed that issue. And certainly, if you can imagine that if we assume that the $250,000 cap would have applied to Norsetter, although that is unclear as he was a county employee,
$250,000
for 29 years of wrongful imprisonment, spending 29 years behind bars, brandished a murderer and a rapist for a crime that you did not commit, I would say is legally inadequate under those circumstances. And I even think the same is true if you look at the 3 years of additional detention that he had to have fighting to get the charges dismissed, since as counsel conceded, he could not have a fair trial without that evidence.
Ms. Warren, let me ask you this. If discovery were to proceed, and of course, I'm putting aside for a second the state of the law issue, which of course is critical for an analysis on qualified immunity. But accepting your position, for the sake of argument, if discovery were to indicate that Norsetter was not involved in the decision to destroy, now your position might be that he should have been involved in the decision to prove it. But I don't know if discovery just produces nothing on who was involved in the decision to destroy the evidence. You would be left with what, just his failure to preserve the evidence? Is that would be your position?
I think that's correct. I mean, I think it's too early to anticipate what discovery would show.
All right. So let's just speculate that it may be difficult at this date to get an accurate reading. That's why I tried to get some inquiry from the other side on the date and who might be directly responsible, not by inaction, but by action. But if we end up with inaction, in the sense that we just cannot determine through discovery, do you have a suggestion as to why qualified immunity then wouldn't apply? Or would you rely solely on the way the investigation was conducted would strip the prosecutor from absolute qualified immunity?
I think you can consider
Field and whatever.
Yes.
I'm familiar with the area.
I think that if we're looking at the conduct and the argument is simply that his malfeasance or his inaction failed to maintain the evidence, we can still look to the previous cases. Perhaps they aren't quote-unquote on all fours, but I think Hope versus Pelzer also tells us we don't have to have a case on all fours. If Norsetter knew...
We seldom do.
If Norsetter knew this evidence was exculpatory for all the reasons that I've already talked about, then he should have also known that not ensuring its preservation would have violated Mr. Armstrong's due process rights. So I don't think we're foreclosed necessarily if it's a inaction versus action case, but obviously the case is much easier if we can prove that Mr. Norsetter had an active hand in destroying it, which is, in fact, taken liberally, what the pro se allegations raise.
Well, I understand, but this is a pro se allegation by a person incarcerated.
At the time he filed, not exactly
tracking the prosecutor's action from his vantage point, right? I mean, I'm not dismissing the allegation, but the allegation that this was a super hands-on approach by this particular prosecutor, which we take and must take, it's still subject to some questionable scrutiny of how that allegation can be based from afar. It's a difficult concept to wrap my mind around how the imprisoned defendant is able to not only get in the mind, but actually know the specifics of the day-to-day preparation for trial.
Well, I think I can answer that two ways. The first is that Defendant Norsetter testified at an evidentiary hearing. So that sort of, which Mr. Armstrong was present for.
Right.
And so that certainly gives Mr. Armstrong a window into what he knew or didn't know, or his credibility, that we don't normally have. I mean, normally prosecutors aren't taking the witness stand. But in addition, this isn't an ordinary prisoner. This is somebody who's life was 3 decades of his life nearly were taken from him. I mean, at the time...
Well, I'm not for a second trying to minimize the facts of this case. I'm just talking about the reality of a prisoner at best being at a hearing, not being too impressed with the testimony of the prosecutor, but I'm questioning how much knowledge he would have of his handling. That's all I'm raising.
And I guess to that point, he does have knowledge, because for 3 decades he was trying to get his conviction overturned. For 3 decades he was fighting.
Well, I'm not questioning his diligence. I'm just questioning his capacity to arrive at the conclusion that he has in putting forth the allegation. That's all. I'm not dismissing him, and I'm not underestimating him, but I'm just trying to get a realistic focus, and then going back to what I put aside for a second, what the state of the law was at the time. And this may be very egregious conduct by a prosecutor, but we have to struggle with the realities of the law then, the law now, and that's the only focus I'm suggesting.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I think to that point, these allegations, while unusual, because we don't see this type of prosecutorial misconduct very often, are certainly plausible on their face, and they're plausible in the context of all of the allegations that Mr. Armstrong has raised in his second amended complaint, and I think that is the focus of the inquiry at this time. I think that the challenges that Mr. Defendant Norsetter has raised are challenges that aren't that he didn't have the capacity to know this information, but that, of course, if Defendant Norsetter thought Mr. Armstrong was guilty, of course he would have preserved this evidence, which we know for a fact that doesn't do justice to Mr. Norsetter or Mr. Armstrong's allegations, and it certainly doesn't read his complaint in the light most favorable to him, taking all the inferences in on his behalf.
If I could just follow up for a second, Ms. Horn, I guess I'm trying to see if I understand. Norsetter's qualified immunity is clearly, I think, the hardest issue in this appeal. And as of 1980, in light of what Trombetta later said, it would seem that if what happened was a negligent oversight that resulted in the loss of this evidence, then Norsetter would be entitled to qualified immunity, if that's what the facts showed.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
On the other hand, if the facts were to show or to support a reasonable inference that he suspected this evidence was exculpatory and recklessly or deliberately allowed it to be destroyed, then this would be a kind of Brady plus, not just suppressing but destroying forever exculpatory evidence, and there would be an argument against qualified immunity on that basis. Is that right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so it would depend on facts that we really can't sort out on the pleadings.
That is plaintiff's position, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. Do we have any rebuttal time? 1 minute? All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I'll use that time to phrase a question. What is the difference between evidence that is suppressed and not revealed until it's too late to use it at trial and evidence that is lost or destroyed and that is not revealed until it is too late to use it at trial? In the first case, under Brady, and in the other case, the court must make a determination whether if that evidence had been made available, there's a reasonable probability the outcome of the trial would have been different. The only difference is in Brady that evidence still exists and a trial can be held. In the other two cases, it does not exist. The court still has to make the same analysis, and if the court determines a fair trial cannot be had without that evidence, which is now gone, the charges are dismissed. That's what happened in this case. But in either case, whether we're talking about evidence lost or destroyed or evidence suppressed, the goal of that evidence is to give the defendant a fair trial. The only difference is whether he gets a fair trial because the evidence still exists, or he no longer can because it doesn't, or the court determines it probably wouldn't have made any difference anyway, in which case he gets a fair trial. That's all I have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walensky. Mr. Yanacek, have any?